chance, devised by the Dark Lord. If it were a thing that gave advantage in battle, I can well believe that Boromir, the proud and fearless, often rash, ever anxious for the victory of Minas Tirith, and his own glory therein, might desire such a thing and be allured by it. Alas, that ever he went on that errand. I should have been chosen by my father and the elders, but he put himself forward as being the older and the hardier, both true, and he would not be stayed. But fear no more. I would not take this thing if it lay by the highway. Not were Minas Tirith falling in ruin, and I alone could save her, so, using the weapon of the Dark Lord for her good and my glory. No, I do not wish for such triumphs, Frodo, son of Drogo. Neither did the council, said Frodo, nor do I. I would have nothing to do with such matters. For myself, said Faramir, I would see the white tree in flower again in the courts of the kings, and the silver crown return, and Minas Tirith in peace. Minas Anor again as of old, full of light, high and fair, beautiful as a queen among other queens, not a mistress of many slaves, nay, not even a kind mistress of willing slaves. War must be, while we defend our lives against a destroyer who would devour all. But I don't love the bright sword for its sharpness, nor the arrow for its swiftness, nor the warrior for his glory. I love only that which they defend, the city of the men of Numenor, and I would have her loved for her memory, her ancientry, her beauty, and her present wisdom. Not feared, save as men may fear the dignity of a man, old and wise. So fear me not. I don't ask you to tell me more. I don't even ask you to tell me whether I now speak nearer the mark. But if you will trust me, it may be that I can advise you in your present quest, whatever that be, yes, and even aid you. Frodo made no answer. Almost he yielded to the desire for help and counsel to tell this grave young man, whose words seemed so wise and fair, all that was in his mind. But something held him back. His heart was heavy with fear and sorrow. If he and Sam were indeed, as seemed likely, all that was now left of the Nine Walkers, then he was in sole command of the secret of their errand. Better mistrust undeserved than rash words. And the memory of Boromir, of the dreadful change that the lure of the ring had worked in him, was very present to his mind when he looked at Faramir and listened to his voice. Unlike they were, and yet also much akin. They walked on in silence for a while, passing like grey and green shadows under the old trees, their feet making no sound. Above them many birds sang, and the sun glistened on the polished roof of dark leaves in the evergreen woods of Ithilien. Sam had taken no part in the conversation, though he had listened. And at the same time he had attended with his keen hobbit ears to all the soft woodland noises about them. One thing he had noted, that in all the talk the name of Gollum had not once come up. He was glad, though he felt that it was too much to hope that he would never hear it again. He soon became aware also that though they walked alone, there were many men close at hand. Not only Damrod and Mablung flitting in and out of the shadows ahead, but others on either side, all making their swift secret way to some appointed place. Once, looking suddenly back, as if some prickle of the skin told him that he was watched from behind, he thought he caught a brief glimpse of a small dark shape slipping behind a tree trunk. He opened his mouth to speak and shut it again. "I'm not sure of it," he said to himself. "And why should I remind them of the old villain, if they choose to forget him? I wish I could." So they passed on, until the woodlands grew thinner and the land began to fall more steeply. Then they turned aside again, to the right, and came quickly to a small river in a narrow gorge. It was the same stream that trickled far above out of the round pool, now grown to a swift torrent, leaping down over many stones in a deep cloven bed, overhung with ilex and dark boxwoods. Looking west, they could see, below them in a haze of light, lowlands and broad meads, and glinting far off in the westering sun the wide waters of the Anduin.
"Here, alas, I must do you a discourtesy," said Faramir. "I hope you will pardon it to one who has so far made his orders give way to courtesy as not to slay you or to bind you. But it is a command that no stranger, not even one of Rohan that fights with us, shall see the path we now go with open eyes. I must blindfold you."
"As you will," said Frodo. "Even the elves do likewise at need, and blindfolded we crossed the borders of fair Lothlorien. Gimli the dwarf took it ill, but the hobbits endured it."
"It is no place so fair that I shall lead you," said Faramir, "but I am glad that you will take this willingly, and not by force."
He called softly, and immediately Marblung and Damrod stepped out of the trees and came back to him. "Blindfold these guests," said Faramir, "securely, but not so as to discomfort them. Do not tie their hands. They will give their word not to try and see. I could trust them to shut their eyes of their own accord, but eyes will blink if the feet stumble. Lead them so that they do not falter." With green scarves the two guards now bound up the hobbit's eyes, and drew their hoods down almost to their mouths. Then quickly they took each one by the hand and went on their way. All that Frodo and Sam knew of this last mile of the road they learned from guessing in the dark. After a little they found that they were on a path descending steeply. Soon it grew so narrow that they went in single file, brushing a stony wall on either side. Their guards steered them from behind with hands laid firmly on their shoulders. Now and again they came to rough places, and were lifted from their feet for a while, and then set down again. Always the noise of the running water was on their right hand, and it grew nearer and louder. At length they were halted. Quickly Marblung and Damrod turned them about, several times, and they lost all sense of direction. They climbed upwards a little. It seemed cold, and the noise of the stream had become faint. Then they were picked up and carried down, down many steps, and round a corner. Suddenly they heard the water again, loud now, rushing and splashing. All round them it seemed, and they felt a fine rain on their hands and cheeks. At last they were set on their feet once more. For a moment they stood so, half fearful, blindfold, not knowing where they were, and no one spoke. Then came the voice of Faramir close behind. "Let them see," he said. The scarves were removed and their hoods drawn back, and they blinked and gasped. They stood on a wet floor of polished stone, the doorstep, as it were, of a rough-hewn gate of rock opening dark behind them. But in front a thin veil of water was hung, so near that Frodo could have put an outstretched arm into it. It faced westward. The level shafts of the setting sun behind beat upon it, and the red light was broken to many flickering beams of ever-changing colour. It was as if they stood at the window of some elven tower, curtained with threaded jewels of silver and gold and ruby, sapphire and amethyst, all kindled with an unconsuming fire.
"At last, by good chance, we come at the right hour to reward you for your patience," said Faramir. "This is the window of the sunset, Henethanun, fairest of all the fair of Ithilien, land of many fountains. Few strangers have ever seen it, but there is no kingly hall behind to match it. Enter now and see." Even as he spoke the sun sank, and the fire faded in the flowing water. They turned and passed under the low, forbidding arch. At once they found themselves in a rock chamber, wide and rough, with an uneven, stooping roof. A few torches were kindled and cast a dim light on the glistening walls. Many men were already there. Others were still coming in by twos and threes through a dark, narrow door on one side. As their eyes grew accustomed to the gloom, the hobbits saw that the cave was larger than they had guessed, and was filled with great store of arms and victuals.
"Well, here is our refuge," said Faramir. "Not a place of great ease, but here you may pass the night in peace. It is dry, at least, and there is food, though no fire. At one time the water flowed down through this cave and out of the arch, but its course was changed further up the gorge by workmen of old, and the stream sent down in a fall of doubled height over the rocks far above. All the ways into this grot were then sealed against the entry of water or aught else, all save one. There are now but two ways, that passage yonder by which you entered blindfold, and through the window curtain into a deep bowl filled with knives of stone. Now rest a while, until the evening meal is set."
The hobbits were taken to a corner and given a low bed to lie on, if they wished. Meanwhile men busied themselves about the cave, quietly and in orderly quickness. Light tables were taken from the walls and set up on trestles and laden with gear. This was plain and unadorned for the most part, but all well and fairly made. Round platters, bowls and dishes of glazed brown clay or turned boxwood, smooth and clean. Here and there was a cup or basin of polished bronze, and a goblet of plain silver was set by the captain's seat in the middle of the inmost table. Faramir went about among the men, questioning each as he came in a soft voice. Some came back from the pursuit of the Southrons. Others, left behind as scouts near the road, came in latest. All the Southrons had been accounted for, save only the great Mumak. What happened to him, none could say. Of the enemy no movement could be seen. Not even an orc spy was abroad.
"You saw and heard nothing, Anborn?" Faramir asked of the latest comer.
"Well, no, lord," said the man. "No orc, at least. But I saw, or thought I saw, something a little strange. It was getting deep dusk, when the eyes made things greater than they should be. So perhaps it may have been no more than a squirrel."
Sam pricked up his ears at this.
"Yet if so, it was a black squirrel, and I saw no tail. 'Twas like a shadow on the ground, and it whisked behind a tree trunk when I drew nigh, and went up aloft as swift as any squirrel could. You will not have us slay wild beasts for no purpose, and it seemed no more, so I tried no arrow. It was too dark for sure shooting anyway, and the creature was gone into the gloom of the leaves in a twinkling. But I stayed for a while, for it seemed strange, and then I hastened back. I thought I heard the thing hiss at me from high above as I turned away. A large squirrel, maybe. Perhaps under the shadow of the unnamed some of the beasts of Mirkwood are wandering hither to our woods. They have black squirrels there, 'tis said."
"Perhaps," said Faramir. "But that would be an ill omen if it were so. We don't want the escapes of Mirkwood in Ithilien." Sam fancied that he gave a swift glance towards the hobbits as he spoke, but Sam said nothing. For a while he and Frodo lay back and watched the torchlight, and the men moving to and fro, speaking in hushed voices. Then suddenly Frodo fell asleep. Sam struggled with himself, arguing this way and that.
"He may be all right," he thought, "and then he may not. Fair speech may hide a foul heart." He yawned. "I could sleep for a week, and I'd be better for it. And what could I do if I do keep awake, me all alone, and all these great men about?"
"Nothing, Sam Gamgee, but you've got to keep awake all the same." And somehow he managed it.
The light faded from the cave door, and the grey veil of falling water grew dim and was lost in gathering shadow. Always the sound of the water went on, never changing its note, morning or evening or night. It murmured and whispered of sleep. Sam stuck his knuckles in his eyes. Now more torches were being lit. A cask of wine was broached. Storage barrels were being opened. Men were fetching water from the fall. Some were laving their hands in basins. A wide copper bowl and a white cloth were brought to Faramir, and he washed. "Wake our guests," he said, "and take them water. It's time to eat."
Frodo sat up and yawned and stretched. Sam, not used to being waited on, looked with some surprise at the tall man who bowed, holding a basin of water before him.
"Put it on the ground, master, if you please," he said. "Easier for me and you."
Then, to the astonishment and amusement of the men, he plunged his head into the cold water and splashed his neck and ears.
"Is it the custom in your land to wash the head before supper?" said the man who waited on the hobbits.
"No, before breakfast," said Sam. "But if you're short of sleep, cold water on the neck's like rain on a wilted lettuce. There! Now I can keep awake long enough to eat a bit."
They were led then to seats beside Faramir. Barrels covered with pelts, and high enough above the benches of the men for their convenience. Before they ate, Faramir and all his men turned and faced west in a moment of silence. Faramir signed to Frodo and Sam that they should do likewise.
"So we always do," he said as they sat down. "We look towards Numenor that was, and beyond to Elvenhome that is, and to that which is beyond Elvenhome and will ever be. Have you no such custom at meat?"
"No," said Frodo, feeling strangely rustic and untutored, "but if we are guests, we bow to our host, and after we have eaten, we rise and thank him."
"That we do also," said Faramir.
After so long journeying and camping, and days spent in the lonely wild, the evening meal seemed a feast to the hobbits. To drink pale yellow wine, cool and fragrant, and eat bread and butter, and salted meats, and dried fruits, and good red cheese with clean hands and clean knives and plates. Neither Frodo nor Sam refused anything that was offered, nor a second, nor indeed a third helping. The wine coursed in their veins and tired limbs, and they felt glad and easy of heart as they had not done since they left the land of Lorien. When all was done, Faramir led them to a recess at the back of the cave, partly screened by curtains, and a chair and two stools were brought there. A little earthenware lamp burned in a niche.
"You may soon desire to sleep," he said, "and especially good Samwise, who would not close his eyes before he ate, whether for fear of blunting the edge of a noble hunger, or for fear of me, I don't know. But it's not good to sleep too soon after meat, and that following a fast. Let us talk a while. On your journey from Rivendell there must have been many things to tell. And you, too, would perhaps wish to learn something of us and the lands where you now are? Tell me of Boromir, my brother, and of old Mithrandir, and of the fair people of Lothlorien."
Frodo no longer felt sleepy, and he was willing to talk. But though the food and wine had put him at his ease, he hadn't lost all his caution. Sam was beaming and humming to himself, but when Frodo spoke, he was at first content to listen, only occasionally venturing to make an exclamation of agreement. Frodo told many tales, yet always he steered the matter away from the quest of the company and from the ring, enlarging rather on the valiant part Boromir had played in all their adventures, with the wolves of the wild, in the snows under Carathras, and in the mines of Moria where Gandalf fell. Faramir was most moved by the story of the fight on the bridge. "It must have irked Boromir to run from orcs," he said, "or even from the fell thing you name, the Balrog, even though he was the last to leave."
"He was the last," said Frodo,
"but Aragorn was forced to lead us.
He alone knew the way after Gandalf's fall, but had there not been us lesser folk to care for, I don't think that either he or Boromir would have fled."
"Maybe it would have been better had Boromir fallen there with Mithrandir," said Faramir, "and not gone on to the fate that waited above the falls of Rauros."
"Maybe. But tell me now of your own fortunes," said Frodo, turning the matter aside once again, "for I would learn more of Minas Ithil and Osgiliath, and Minas Tirith the long-enduring. What hope have you for that city in your long war?"
"What hope have we?" said Faramir. "It is long since we had any hope. The sword of Elendil, if it returns indeed, may rekindle it. But I don't think that it will do more than put off the evil day, unless other help unlooked for also comes, from elves or men. For the enemy increases, and we decrease. We are a failing people, a springless autumn. The men of Numenor were settled far and wide on the shores and seaward regions of the great lands, but for the most part they fell into evils and follies. Many became enamoured of the darkness and the black arts. Some were given over wholly to idleness and ease, and some fought among themselves, until they were conquered in their weakness by the wild men. It's not said that evil arts were ever practised in Gondor, or that the Nameless One was ever named in honour there, and the old wisdom and beauty brought out of the West remained long in the realm of the sons of Elendil the Fair, and they linger there still. Yet even so it was Gondor that brought about its own decay, falling by degrees into dotage, and thinking that the enemy was asleep, who was only banished, not destroyed. Death was ever present, because the Numenoreans still, as they had in their old kingdom, and so lost it, hungered after endless life unchanging. Kings made tombs more splendid than houses of the living, and counted old names in the rolls of their descent dearer than the names of sons. Childless lords sat in aged halls musing on heraldry. In secret chambers withered men compounded strong elixirs, or in high cold towers asked questions of the stars, and the last king of the line of Anarion had no heir. But the stewards were wiser and more fortunate. Wiser, for they recruited the strength of our people from the sturdy folk of the sea-coast, and from the hardy mountaineers of Ered Nibraeus, and they made a truce with the proud peoples of the north, who often had assailed us, men of fierce valour, but our kin from afar off, unlike the wild Easterlings or the cruel Haradrim. So it came to pass in the days of Cirion the 12th steward, and my father is the 26th, that they rode to our aid, and at the great field of Celebrant they destroyed our enemies that had seized our northern provinces. These are the Rohirrim, as we name them, masters of horses, and we ceded to them the fields of Calenarthon, that are since called Rohan, for that province had long been sparsely peopled, and they became our allies, and have ever proved true to us, aiding us at need, and guarding our northern marches and the gap of Rohan. Of our law and manners they have learned what they would, and their lords speak our speech at need. Yet for the most part they hold by the ways of their own fathers and to their own memories, and they speak among themselves their own north tongue. And we love them, tall men and fair women, valiant both alike, golden-haired, bright-eyed, and strong. They remind us of the youth of men, as they were in the elder days. Indeed, it's said by our law-masters that they have from old this affinity with us, that they are come from those same three houses of men as were the Numenoreans in their beginning, not from Hador the Golden-Head, the Elfriend, maybe, yet from such of his sons and people as went not oversea into the west, refusing the call. For so we reckon men in our law, calling them the High, or Men of the West, which were Numenoreans, and the Middle Peoples, Men of the Twilight, such as are the Rohirrim of their kin, that dwell still far in the north, and the Wild, the Men of Darkness. Yet now, if the Rohirrim are grown in some ways more like to us, enhanced in arts and gentleness, we too have become more like to them, and can scarce claim any longer the title High. We are become middlemen of the twilight, but with memory of other things. For as the Rohirrim do, we now love war and valour as things good in themselves, both a sport and an end. And though we still hold that a warrior should have more skills and knowledge than only the craft of weapons and slaying, we esteem a warrior, nonetheless, above men of other crafts. Such is the need of our days. So even was my brother, Boromir, a man of prowess, and for that he was accounted the best man in Gondor. And very valiant indeed he was, no heir of Minas Tirith
as for long years been so hardy in toil, so onward into battle, or blown a mightier note on the great horn. Faramir sighed and fell silent for a while.
"You don't say much in all your tales about the elves, sir," said Sam, suddenly plucking up courage. He'd noted that Faramir seemed to refer to elves with reverence, and this even more than his courtesy, and his food and wine had won Sam's respect and quieted his suspicions.
"No, indeed, Master Samwise," said Faramir, "for I'm not learned in elven lore. But there you touch upon another point in which we have changed, declining from Numenor to Middle-earth.
For as you may know, if Mithrandir was your companion and you have spoken with Elrond, the Edain, the fathers of the Numenorians, fought beside the elves in the first wars, and were awarded by the gift of the kingdom in the midst of the sea, within sight of Elvenhome. But in Middle-earth men and elves became estranged in the days of darkness, by the arts of the enemy, and by the slow changes of time in which each kind walked further down their sundered roads. Men now fear and misdoubt the elves, and yet know little of them, and we of Gondor grow like other men, like the men of Rohan, for even they, who are the foes of the Dark Lord, shun the elves and speak of the Golden Wood with dread. Yet there are among us still some who have dealings with the elves when they may, and ever and anon one will go in secret to Lorien, seldom to return. Not I. For I deem it perilous now for mortal man wilfully to seek out the elder people. Yet I envy you that have spoken with the White Lady."
"The Lady of Lorien, Galadriel?" cried Sam. "You should see her. Indeed you should, sir. I'm only a hobbit, and gardening's my job at home, sir, if you understand me, and I'm not much good at poetry, not at making it. A bit of a comic rhyme, perhaps, now and again, you know, but not real poetry, so I can't tell you what I mean. It ought to be sung. You'd have to get Strider, Aragorn, that is, or old Mr. Bilbo for that. But I wish I could make a song about her. Beautiful she is, sir. Lovely. Sometimes like a great tree in flower, sometimes like a white daffodowndilly, small and slender-like. Hard as diamonds, soft as moonlight, warm as sunlight, cold as frost in the stars. Proud and far off as a snow mountain, and as merry as any lass I ever saw with daisies in her hair in springtime. But that's a lot of nonsense, and all wide of my mark."
"Then she must be lovely indeed," said Faramir, "perilously fair."
"I don't know about perilous," said Sam.
"It strikes me that folk takes their peril with them into Lorien, and finds it there because they brought it. But perhaps you could call her perilous, because she's so strong in herself. You could dash yourself to pieces on her, like a ship on a rock, or drown yourself, like a hobbit in a river. But neither rock nor river would be to blame. Now borrow—" He stopped and went red in the face.
"Yes? Now, Boromir, you would say?" said Faramir. "What would you say? He took his peril with him?"
"Yes, sir. Begging your pardon. And a fine man as your brother was, if I may say so. But you've been warm on the scent all along. Now, I watched Boromir and listened to him, from Rivendell all down the road, looking after my master, as you'll understand, and not meaning any harm to Boromir. And it's my opinion that in Lorien he first saw clearly what I guessed sooner, what he wanted. From the moment he first saw it, he wanted the enemy's ring."
"Sam!" cried Frodo aghast.
He'd fallen deep into his own thoughts for a while, and came out of them suddenly and too late.
"Save me!" said Sam, turning white, and then flushing scarlet. "There I go again! Whenever you open your big mouth and put your foot in it, the gaffer used to say to me, and right enough, oh dear, oh dear. Now, look here, sir," he turned, facing up to Faramir with all the courage that he could muster, "don't you go taking advantage of my master because his servant's no better than a fool. You've spoken very handsome all along, put me off my guard, talking of elves and all, but handsome is as handsome does, we say.
Now's a chance to show your quality."
"So it seems," said Faramir slowly and very softly, with a strange smile. "So that is the answer to all the riddles. The one ring that was thought to have perished from the world, and Boromir tried to take it by force, and you escaped, and ran all the way to me. And here in the wild I have you, two halflings, and a host of men at my call, and the Ring of Rings. A pretty stroke of fortune. A chance for Faramir, captain of Gondor, to show his quality. Ah!" He stood up very tall and stern, his grey eyes glinting. Frodo and Sam sprang from their stools and set themselves side by side with their backs to the wall, fumbling for their sword hilts. There was a silence. All the men in the cave stopped talking and looked towards them in wonder. But Faramir sat down again in his chair and began to laugh quietly, and then suddenly became grave again. "Alas for Boromir. It was too sore a trial," he said. "How you have increased my sorrow, you two strange wanderers from a far country, bearing the peril of men. But you are less judges of men than I of halflings. We are truth-speakers, we men of Gondor. We boast seldom, and then perform, or die in the attempt. Not if I found it on the highway would I take it," I said. "Even if I were such a man as to desire this thing, and even though I knew not clearly what this thing was when I spoke, still I should take those words as a vow, and be held by them. But I am not such a man, or I am wise enough to know that there are some perils from which a man must flee. Sit at peace, and be comforted, Samwise. If you seem to have stumbled, think that it was fated to be so. Your heart is shrewd as well as faithful, and saw clearer than your eyes. For strange though it may seem, it was safe to declare this to me. It may even help the master that you love. It shall turn to his good, if it is in my power, so be comforted. But do not even name this thing again aloud. Once is enough." The hobbits came back to their seats and sat very quiet. Men turned back to their drink and their talk, perceiving that their captain had had some jest or other with the little guests, and that it was over. "Well, Frodo, now at last we understand one another," said Faramir. "If you took this thing on yourself, unwilling, at others asking, then you have pity and honour from me, and I marvel at you, to keep it hid and not to use it. You are a new people, and a new world to me." "Are all your kin of like sort? Your land must be a realm of peace and content, and there must gardeners be in high honour." "Not all is well there," said Frodo, "but certainly gardeners are honoured. But folk must grow weary there, even in their gardens, as do all things under the sun of this world, and you are far from home and wayworn. No more tonight. Sleep, both of you, in peace, if you can. Fear not. I don't wish to see it, or touch it, or know more of it than I know, which is enough, lest peril perchance waylay me, and I fall lower in the test than Frodo, son of Drogo. Go now to rest. But first tell me only, if you will, whither you wish to go, and what to do. For I must watch, and wait, and think. Time passes. In the morning we must each go swiftly on the ways appointed to us." Frodo had felt himself trembling as the first shock of fear passed. Now a great weariness came down on him like a cloud. He could dissemble and resist no longer. "I was going to find a way into Mordor," he said faintly. "I was going to Gorgoroth. I must find the Mountain of Fire and cast the thing into the Gulf of Doom. Gandalf said so. I don't think I shall ever get there." Faramir stared at him for a moment in grave astonishment. Then suddenly he caught him as he swayed, and lifting him gently, carried him to the bed and laid him there, and covered him warmly. At once he fell into a deep sleep. Another bed was set beside him for his servant. Sam hesitated for a moment, then bowing very low, "Good night, Captain, my lord," he said.
You took the chance, sir.
Did I so? Said Faramir.
Yes, sir, and showed your quality of the very highest.
Faramir smiled.
A pert servant, Master Samwise, but nay, the praise of the praiseworthy is above all rewards. Yet there was naught in this to praise. I had no lure or desire to do other than I have done.
Ah, well, sir,
said Sam,
you said my master had an elvish air, and that was good and true. But I can say this. You have an air, too, sir, that reminds me of Gandalf, of wizards.
Maybe, said Faramir, maybe you discern from far away the air of Numenor. Good night.
Chapter 6 The Forbidden Pool. Frodo woke to find Faramir bending over him. For a second old fears seized him, and he sat up and shrank away.
"There is nothing to fear," said Faramir.
"Is it morning already?" said Frodo, yawning.
"Not yet, but night is drawing to an end, and the full moon is setting. Will you come and see it? Also there is a matter on which I desire your counsel. I'm sorry to rouse you from sleep, but will you come?"
"I will," said Frodo, rising and shivering a little, as he left the warm blanket and pelts. It seemed cold in the fireless cave. The noise of the water was loud in the stillness. He put on his cloak and followed Faramir. Sam, waking suddenly by some instinct of watchfulness, saw first his master's empty bed and leapt to his feet. Then he saw two dark figures, Frodo and a man, framed against the archway, which was now filled with a pale white light. He hurried after them, past rows of men sleeping on mattresses along the wall. As he went by the cave mouth, he saw that the curtain was now become a dazzling veil of silk and pearls and silver thread, melting icicles of moonlight. But he did not pause to admire it, and turning aside he followed his master through the narrow doorway in the wall of the cave. They went first along a black passage, then up many wet steps, and so came to a small flat landing cut in the stone and lit by the pale sky, gleaming high above through a long deep shaft. From here two flights of steps led, one going on, as it seemed, up on to the high bank of the stream, the other turning away to the left. This they followed. It wound its way up like a turret stair. At last they came out of the stony darkness and looked about. They were on a wide, flat rock without rail or parapet. At their right, eastwards, the torrent fell, splashing over many terraces, and then, pouring down a steep race, it filled a smooth-hewn channel with a dark force of water flecked with foam, and curling and rushing almost at their feet, it plunged sheer over the edge that yawned upon their left. A man stood there, near the brink, silent, gazing down. Frodo turned to watch the sleek necks of the water as they curved and dived. Then he lifted his eyes and gazed far away. The world was quiet and cold, as if dawn were near. Far off in the west, the full moon was sinking, round and white. Pale mists shimmered in the great vale below. A wide gulf of silver fume, beneath which rolled the cool night waters of the Anduin. A black darkness loomed beyond, and in it glinted, here and there, cold, sharp, remote, white as the teeth of ghosts, the peaks of Ered Nimraeus, the white mountains of the realm of Gondor, tipped with everlasting snow. For a while Frodo stood there on the high stone, and a shiver ran through him, wondering if anywhere in the vastness of the nightlands his old companions walked or slept, or lay dead shrouded in mist. Why was he brought here out of forgetful sleep? Sam was eager for an answer to the same question, and could not refrain himself from muttering, for his master's ear alone, as he thought, "It's a fine view, no doubt, Mr. Frodo, but chilly to the heart, not to mention the bones. What's going on?" Faramir heard and answered, "Moon set over Gondor. Fair Ithil, as it goes from Middle-earth, glances upon the white locks of old Mindolwin.
It is worth a few shivers. But that is not what I brought you to see, though as for you, Samwise, you were not brought, and do but pay the penalty of your watchfulness. A draught of wine shall amend it. Come, look now. He stepped up beside the silent sentinel on the dark edge, and Frodo followed. Sam hung back. He already felt insecure enough on this high, wet platform. Faramir and Frodo looked down. Far below them, they saw the white waters pour into a foaming bowl, and then swirl darkly about a deep oval basin in the rocks, until they found their way out again through a narrow gate, and flowed away, fuming and chattering, into calmer and more level reaches. The moonlight still slanted down to the fall's foot, and gleamed on the ripples of the basin. Presently Frodo was aware of a small, dark thing on the near bank. But even as he looked at it, it dived and vanished just beyond the boil and bubble of the fall, cleaving the black water as neatly as an arrow or an edgewise stone. Faramir turned to the man at his side. "Now what would you say that is, Unborn? A squirrel or a kingfisher? Are there black kingfishers in the night pools of Mirkwood?"
"'Tis not a bird, whatever else it be," answered Unborn. "It has four limbs and dives manwise. A pretty mastery of the craft it shows, too. What is it at? Seeking a way up behind the curtain to our hidings? It seems we're discovered at last. I have my bow here, and I have posted other archers, nigh as good marksmen as myself, on either bank. We wait only for your command to shoot, Captain."
"Shall we shoot?" said Faramir, turning quickly to Frodo. Frodo didn't answer for a moment, then, "No," he said, "no, I beg you not to." If Sam had dared, he would have said, "Yes," quick and loud. He couldn't see, but he guessed well enough from their words what they were looking at. "You know, then, what this thing is?" said Faramir. "Come now, you have seen. Tell me why it should be spared. In all our words together you have not once spoken of your gangrel companion, and I let him be for the time. He could wait till he was caught and brought before us. I sent my keenest huntsman to seek him, but he slipped them, and they had no sight of him till now, save Unborn here, once at dusk yester evening. But now he's done worse trespass than only to go coney-snaring in the uplands. He has dared to come to Hinnith Annwn, and his life is forfeit. I marvel at the creature, so secret and so sly as he is, to come sporting in the pool before our very window. Does he think that men sleep without watch all night? Why does he so?"
"There are two answers, I think," said Frodo. "For one thing, he knows little of men, and sly though he is, your refuge is so hidden that perhaps he does not know that men are concealed here. For another, I think he is allured here by a mastering desire stronger than his caution."
"He is lured here, then, you say?" said Faramir in a low voice. "Can he, does he then know of your burden?"
"Indeed, yes. He bore it himself for many years."
"He bore it?" said Faramir, breathing sharply in his wonder. "This matter winds itself ever in new riddles. Then he is pursuing it?"
"Maybe. It is precious to him. But I did not speak of that."
"What then does the creature seek?"
"Fish," said Frodo. "Look." They peered down at the dark pool. A little black head appeared at the far end of the basin, just out of the deep shadow of the rocks. There was a brief silver glint, and a swirl of tiny ripples. It swam to the side, and then with marvellous agility a frog-like figure climbed out of the water and up the bank. At once it sat down and began to gnaw at the small silver thing that glittered as it turned. The last rays of the moon were now falling behind the stony wall at the pool's end. Faramir laughed softly.
"Fish," he said. "It is a less perilous hunger. Or maybe not. Fish from the pool of Hinnith Annwn may cost him all he has to give."
"Now I have him at the arrow point," said Unborn. "Shall I not shoot, Captain? For coming unbidden to this place, death is our law."
"Wait, Unborn," said Faramir.
"'This is a harder matter than it seems. "'What have you to say now, Frodo? "'Why should we spare?'
"'The creature is wretched and hungry,' said Frodo, "'and unaware of his danger.
"'And Gandalf, your Mithrandir, "'he would have bidden you not to slay him for that reason, "'and for others. "'He forbade the elves to do so. "'I don't know clearly why, "'and of what I guess I cannot speak openly out here.' But this creature is in some way bound up with my errand. Until you found us and took us, he was my guide.
Your guide, said Faramir. The matter becomes ever stranger.
I would do much for you, Frodo, but this I cannot grant. To let this sly wanderer go free, at his own will from here, to join you later if it please him, or to be caught by orcs and tell all he knows under threat of pain. He must be slain or taken. "'Slain, if he be not taken very swiftly. "'But how can this slippery thing of many guises be caught, "'save by a feathered draught?
"'Let me go down quietly to him,' said Frodo. "'You may keep your bows bent, and shoot me at least if I fail. "'I shan't run away.'
"'Go then and be swift,' said Faramir. "'If he comes off alive, he should be your faithful servant for the rest of his unhappy days.' "'Lead Frodo down to the bank, unborn, and go softly. "'The thing has a nose and ears. "'Give me your bow.'
"'Unborn grunted, and led the way down the winding stair to the landing, "'and then up the other stair, "'until at last they came to a narrow opening, shrouded with thick bushes. "'Passing silently through, Frodo found himself on the top of the southern bank above the pool. "'It was now dark, and the falls were pale and grey. "'Reflecting only the lingering moonlight of the western sky. "'He couldn't see Gollum. "'He went forward a short way, and Unborn came softly behind him. "'Go on,' he breathed in Frodo's ear. "'Have a care to your right. "'If you fall in the pool, then no one but your fishing friend can help you. "'And forget not that there are bowmen near at hand, though you may not see them.' "'Frodo crept forward. "'Using his hands, Gollum-like, to feel his way and to steady himself. "'The rocks were, for the most part, flat and smooth, but slippery. "'He halted, listening. "'At first he could hear no sound but the unceasing rush of the fall behind him. "'Then presently he heard, not far ahead, a hissing murmur.
"'Fish! Nice fish! "'White face has vanished, my precious, at last, yes!' Now we can eat fish in peace. No, not in peace, precious, for precious is last year's lost. Dirty hobbits, nasty hobbits, gone and left us, Gollum, and precious is gone. Only poor Smeagol all alone. No, precious, nasty men, they'll take it, steal my precious. Thieves, we hate them. Fish, nice fish, makes us strong, makes eyes bright, fingers tight, yes. Throttle them, precious, throttle them all, yes, if we get chances. Nice fish, nice fish.
So it went on. Almost as unceasing as the waterfall, only interrupted by a faint noise of slavering and gurgling. Frodo shivered, listening with pity and disgust. He wished it would stop, and that he never need hear that voice again. Anborn was not far behind. He could creep back and ask him to get the huntsman to shoot.
They would probably get close enough, while Gollum was gorging and off his guard. Only one true shot— and Frodo would be rid of the miserable voice for ever. But no. Gollum had a claim on him now. The servant has a claim on the master for service, even service in fear. They would have found it in the dead marshes but for Gollum. Frodo knew, too, somehow quite clearly that Gandalf would not have wished it.
"Smeagol," he said softly.
"Fish. Nice fish," said the voice.
"Smeagol," he said a little louder. The voice stopped. "Smeagol, master has come to look for you. Master is here. Come, Smeagol." There was no answer but a soft hiss, as of intaken breath.
"Come, Smeagol," said Frodo. "We're in danger. Men will kill you If they find you here, come quickly, if you wish to escape death. Come to master.
No, said the voice. Not nice master. Leaves poor Smeagol and goes with new friends. Master can wait. Smeagol hasn't finished.
There's no time, said Frodo. Bring fish with you. Come.
No, must finish fish.
Smeagol, said Frodo desperately, Precious will be angry. I shall take Precious, and I shall say, Make him swallow the bones and choke. Never taste fish again. Come, Precious is waiting. There was a sharp hiss. Presently, out of the darkness, Gollum came crawling on all fours, like an erring dog called to heel. He had a half-eaten fish in his mouth and another in his hand. He came close to Frodo, almost nose to nose, and sniffed at him. His pale eyes were shining. Then he took the fish out of his mouth and stood up.
"Nice master," he whispered. "Nice hobbit. Come back to poor Smeagol. Good Smeagol comes. Now let's go. Go quickly, yes, through the trees, while the faces are dark. Yes, come, let's go."
"Yes, we'll go soon," said Frodo, "but not at once. I will go with you as I promised. I promise again, but not now. You are not safe yet. I will save you, but you must trust me."
"We must trust master," said Gollum doubtfully. "Why? Why not go at once? Where is the other one, the cross, rude hobbit? Where is he?"
"Away up there," said Frodo, pointing to the waterfall. "I'm not going without him. We must go back to him." His heart sank. This was too much like trickery. He didn't really fear that Faramir would allow Gollum to be killed, and he would probably make him prisoner and bind him. And certainly what Frodo did would seem a treachery to the poor, treacherous creature. It would probably be impossible ever to make him understand or believe that Frodo had saved his life in the only way he could. What else could he do? To keep faith, as near as might be, with both sides? "Come," he said, "or the Precious will be angry. We are going back now, up the stream. Go on, go on, you go in front." Gollum crawled along close to the bank for a little way, snuffling and suspicious. Presently he stopped and raised his head.
"Something's there," he said. "Not a hobbit."
Suddenly he turned back. A green light was flickering in his bulging eyes.
"Master, master," he hissed. "Wicked. Tricksy! False!"
He spat and stretched out his long arms with white snapping fingers. At that moment the great black shape of Unborn loomed up behind him and came down on him. A large strong hand took him in the nape of the neck and pinned him. He twisted round like lightning, all wet and slimy as he was, wriggling like an eel, biting and scratching like a cat. But two more men came up out of the shadows.
"Hold still," said one. "Or we'll stick you as full of pins as a hedgehog. Hold still."
Gollum went limp, and began to whine and weep. They tied him, none too gently. "Easy, easy," said Frodo. "He has no strength to match you. Don't hurt him if you can help it. He'll be quieter if you don't. Smeagol, they won't hurt you. I'll go with you, and you shall come to no harm. Not unless they kill me too. Trust master." Gollum turned and spat at him. The men picked him up, put a hood over his eyes, and carried him off. Frodo followed them, feeling very wretched. They went through the opening behind the bushes and back, down the stairs and passages into the cave. Two or three torches had been lit. Men were stirring. Sam was there, and he gave a queer look at the limp bundle that the men carried. "Got him?" he said to Frodo. "Yes. Well, no, I didn't get him. He came to me. Because he trusted me at first, I'm afraid. I didn't want him tied up like this. I hope it will be all right, but I hate the whole business."
"So do I," said Sam. "And nothing will ever be all right where that piece of misery is."
A man came and beckoned to the hobbits, and took them to the recess at the back of the cave. Faramir was sitting there in his chair, and the lamp had been rekindled in its niche above his head. He signed to them to sit down on the stools beside him.
"Bring wine for the guests," he said, "and bring the prisoner to me.
The wine was brought, and then Unborn came carrying Gollum. He had removed the cover from Gollum's head and set him on his feet, standing behind him to support him. Gollum blinked, hooding the malice of his eyes with the heavy, pale lids. A very miserable creature he looked, dripping and dank, smelling of fish. He still clutched one in his hand. His sparse locks were hanging like rank weed over his bony brows. His nose was snivelling.
"Loose us," he said. "The cord hurts us. Yes, it does. It hurts us, and we've done nothing."
"Nothing?" said Faramir, looking at the wretched creature with a keen glance, but without any expression in his face either of anger or pity or wonder. "Nothing? Have you never done anything worthy of binding or of worse punishment? However, that is not for me to judge, happily. But tonight you have come where it is death to come. The fish of this pool are dearly bought." Gollum dropped the fish from his hand.
"Don't want fish," he said.
"The price is not set on the fish," said Faramir. "Only to come here and look on the pool bears the penalty of death. I've spared you so far at the prayer of Frodo here, who says that of him, at least, you have deserved some thanks. But you must also satisfy me. What is your name? Whence do you come? And whither do you go? What is your business?"
"We are lost, lost," said Gollum. "No name, no business, no precious, nothing, only empty, only hungry. Yes, we're hungry. A few little fishes, nasty, bony little fishes, for a poor creature, and they say death. So wise they are, so just, so very just."
"Not very wise," said Faramir, "but just. Yes, perhaps, as just as our little wisdom allows. Unloose him, Frodo." Faramir took a small nail knife from his belt and handed it to Frodo. Gollum, misunderstanding the gesture, squealed and fell down. "Now, Smeagol," said Frodo, "you must trust me. I will not desert you. Answer truthfully, if you can. It will do you good, not harm." He cut the cords on Gollum's wrists and ankles and raised him to his feet. "Come hither," said Faramir. "Look at me. Do you know the name of this place? Have you been here before?" Slowly Gollum raised his eyes and looked unwillingly into Faramir's. All light went out of them, and they stared bleak and pale for a moment into the clear, unwavering eyes of the man of Gondor. There was a still silence. Then Gollum dropped his head and shrank down, until he was squatting on the floor, shivering.
"We doesn't know, and we doesn't want to know," he whimpered. "Never came here, never come again."
"There are locked doors and closed windows in your mind, and dark rooms behind them," said Faramir. "But in this I judge that you speak the truth. It is well for you. What oath will you swear never to return, and never to lead any living creature hither by word or sign?"
"Master knows," said Gollum with a sidelong glance at Frodo. "Yes, he knows. We will promise Master, if he saves us. We'll promise to it."
"Yes." He crawled to Frodo's feet.
"Save us, nice master," he whined. "Smeagol promises to precious, promises faithfully. Never come again, never speak, no, never, no, precious, no."
"Are you satisfied?" said Faramir. "Yes," said Frodo. "At least you must either accept this promise or carry out your law. You'll get no more, but I promised that if he came to me, he should not be harmed, and I would not be proved faithless." Faramir sat for a moment in thought. "Very good," he said at last. "I surrender you to your master, to Frodo, son of Drogo. Let him declare what he will do with you."
"But, Lord Faramir," said Frodo, bowing, "you have not yet declared your will concerning the said Frodo, and until that is made known, he cannot shape his plans for himself or his companions. Your judgment was postponed until the morning, but that is now at hand."
"Then I will declare my doom," said Faramir. "As for you, Frodo,
In so far as lies in me under higher authority, I declare you free in the realm of Gondor, to the furthest of its ancient bounds, save only that neither you nor any